You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity entirely. We thank you for listening. We're glad you're here tonight, and we're going to stick with the significant national security issues we're facing with the rapid development of AI. We're also going to discuss the limitations of battery technology in this series, the specter or the promise that is quantum computing, as well as changes in the kinetic aspects of conflict, which give rise to this discussion as we're watching it play out in real time right now in Ukraine. You notice there are tanks, but there are a lot more drones. Part of this discussion includes an acknowledgement of how our energy needs are going to change drastically in the coming years. We understand that the concept of nuclear energy frequently scares the public, and for given good reason, given the consequences of accidents such as the one at Chernobyl and the one at Three Mile Island. And by the way, for those of you who are like between 12 and 25, that is ancient. It was memorialized by Shakespeare. You can find it in one of the sonnets. But actually, I think both of those events took place either in the, 70s, 80s, around there. But nuclear is also being discussed as a possible serious solution to greenhouse gases, which are caused by the burning of fossil fuels and, of course, traditional combustion engines. But in national security, energy is critical to modern warfare. And energy that is delivered to the systems that need it in a mobile theater of war, which is going to be a bonus part of this convo today. So in the context of modern warfare, micro reactors, I call them bonsai reactors now, I'm just going to let that stick. They may be critical to the logistical challenges that we're facing right now. And who better to explain this than Jeff Waxman, the program manager of the Strategic Capabilities Office at the Department of Defense, where he leads something called Project Pele. I'm going to need an explanation for that. Was a big fan of Pele. Not only am I here in my individual capacity, but of course, so is Jeff. He does not speak for the Department of Defense. So Jeff, thanks so much for coming in. We're really glad you're here.
Thank you. It's a very kind introduction.
Let's start at the very beginning, which is what the heck is Project Pele? And can you lace in there for my sake? How on earth did you come up with that name?
So actually, I didn't come up with a name. So I was hired to start the program. When I started, we had no money, but I was handed a 2-page white paper with the name Pele and saying what they wanted Project Pele to be. So Pele was actually named by our cell at Indo-PACOM. So that's the folks in Hawaii who oversee the Indo-Pacific region. They actually named Pele not after the soccer player, but after the goddess of power. So I've actually taken a trip to the Big Island of Hawaii and visited her crater. We backronymed it to Portable Energy for Lasting Effects. But what it really is it's a transportable nuclear reactor. So the premise is that it's a nuclear reactor that can be transported on a plane or by truck. This is not a truck-mounted reactor. So you're not going to walk up to the truck and plug in your cell phone. It's going to take a little while to set it up, probably 3 to 4 days to set the reactor up and probably a week to tear it down when you're done. But this reactor will put out around about a megawatt of power for several years without refueling. So a megawatt is a lot of power. It's equivalent to 1,000 homes. And we start thinking about DoD energy purposes. You're thinking about radar systems or mobile hospitals or communication centers. Those are typically on the order of magnitude of about a megawatt. So that's what Project Pele is.
Okay, that just sounds amazing. Obviously, they pulled you in to do this. What was your background? What made you the right guy for this job? Because you clearly are.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm just a pretty face. I like to say all the smarter people are actually doing the engineering work, but they wanted someone who had enough of a technical background to be dangerous. You know, I do have graduate degrees and those sorts of things. I had worked in private sector for a little while, but I've also worked for Congress and I'd also worked for the NASA administrator. So I'd seen the other side of how budgets get done and how policy gets done. Because as a program manager, you're not actually really involved in the details of designing or building your system. What my job is more than anything is clearing the regulatory hurdles, making sure we have uranium, making sure that everything that we're doing is legal, that we're not going to get sued, that we're doing NEPA, all the various things that you have to do to make sure that something goes from a PowerPoint to actual hardware. More than anything, that's what my focus is. And the history of advanced nuclear reactor programs across the federal government has been just a litany of failure, nothing even getting to hardware. So the fact that we're actually at hardware is a tremendous success. I think the all-star team of talent that has been assembled to execute Pele, both at the Department of Defense and also at the DOE, particularly the DOE laboratories, Idaho National Lab, Argonne, Pacific Northwest National Lab, et cetera. It's a tremendous credit to the team that we've gone as far as we have already.
Okay, well, that was a humble introduction. You don't just have a graduate degree. You have a PhD in physics, but to...
While I have a master's degree in nuclear engineering, my PhD is actually in fusion physics. So I have some fusion expertise. But in terms of trying to get power that can be used by the warfighter by 2030, the reality is it's fission. Fusion's a bit longer term off, as much as I love fusion.
I've heard you talk about how you must be a history buff. Like, you seem to like the history of warfare. But you have talked about how logistics mastery has won wars. Why don't you give us some examples from history, and then we can talk about what makes Pele nimble and a part of this process.
Sure. So there's a famous quote that says, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. It's been attributed to pretty much everyone from Napoleon to Caesar. It's probably one of those ones where, you know, it just gets latched onto people. But the reality is, if you look at all warfare going back hundreds of years, it is logistics and the overarching strategy that decides who wins wars. It is not the glamorous stuff that's in movies, the bayonet charges and the brilliant tactical maneuvers. That is not what wins wars. You know, when you look at World War II or World War I, those wars were not won because better generals or better tanks or better planes. World War II, the Germans had all the famous generals. They had the best tanks. They had the best planes. But we could produce 50 times as many, and we can get our oil and fuel and steel to all the places that we need to get to go. And our adversaries couldn't, especially when you look at the modern day, the sort of warfare that we're looking at. You were mentioning drones before. You think about missile defense systems, cyber warfare, space warfare. It is so incredibly energy and logistics dense. The era of just give rifles to people and have them go take that hill, that is not the warfare that we're looking at anymore. Even when you look at a conflict like Armenia versus Azerbaijan, it was just drones going at each other. This is just what it's going to be. Having the logistics to make that happen is going to be so critical. And I beg anyone who looks at maps to please pull out a globe and understand how big the Pacific Ocean is and how all the logistics challenges that we've seen in other conflicts are going to be magnified even a factor of 10 if anything were to ever happen in the Pacific. It's not necessarily sexy to think about energy and logistics. You know, it's not what people go to the Pentagon wanting to do. The joke is, you know, if you can't explain how your system is going to kill Chinese people, people aren't interested in funding it, right? I mean, that's kind of the joke. But the reality is that you can't do anything without energy. When you war game this, when you look at, we call them O plans, you know, the war plans for a major conflict, everything is about this overarching strategy of logistics. To go back to Napoleon, he used to say that an army marches on its stomach. And he knows more than anybody, or he did, failure of logistics when he invaded Russia. So while it's not sexy, this is what wins wars. And it's why I've been spending the last 6.5 years focused on this problem.
Talk a little bit about how Pele is going to improve military logistics, if it is. I'm sure it is, or I don't think we'd be spending money and time on it. In a Department of Defense, it can at times be laden with things like procurement policies, acquisitions rules. I mean, this sounds like a screaming wild success and in a very short time frame.
Yeah, well, you know, I give a lot of the credit for that to the organization I'm in. So I'm within an organization called the Strategic Capabilities Office. We are not a well-known organization. We generally don't promote ourselves. Ironically, the nuclear program is by far the most unclassified program that we have, but we are allowed to really work freely. They trust their veteran program managers to make decisions and just execute. And you don't need to have, you know, 9 permissions to make decisions. But, you know, in terms of the logistical challenge, when you look at electricity on bases, if you look at the way we do backup power right now, so you think about any sort of critical infrastructure that the DoD has, so whether that is missile defense radar or computer systems or whatever it is, it has to have power. The backup for that system, I could almost guarantee you 100% of the time, is diesel generators. That's what we use. And we have diesel generators tied into the specific system that they are. Think about a missile defense radar will typically have 2 diesel generators plugged into it. The radar system has been sized to the diesel generator, and then they run 2 simultaneously because that way, if one of them trips off, the second one will immediately come on because it needs power 24/7. So not only are we using diesel fuel, which is hard to move around, but also we're burning twice as much as we need to because we have to always have 2 on at the same time. It's kind of exasperating. And you start to think about, well, okay, well, let's build microgrids, right? You say, okay, that's an obvious answer. Let's build microgrids. Well, I've sat through a lot of presentations on microgrids. And it always starts off with a cartoon of some solar panels and a couple batteries and a beautiful microgrid. And then you get to, you know, slide 7 and you go, well, what's actually built here? Diesel generators. The reason is because it's actually extraordinarily difficult to use intermittent power sources on microgrids. I think people have a misperception of how electricity works in general. It's something very confusing.
Yeah. And you know, I want to pause you because you're saying grid. And I'll be frank, people don't know what the grid or a grid is. If you don't mind, as you offer a more detailed explanation, just do a quick explainer.
Sure. Let's have a military base that is over a few square miles and everything is plugged into a set of wires, right? We all think about the wires that go into our house and we think about, well, I have something that produces power and then I have various things that use that power. And I think the way most people intuit the way that that works is they think about it like a bucket that we're pouring water into and there's a hole in the bottom that water is coming out of. And as long as I'm putting enough water in, then I have water flowing out and everything's okay. But this is actually not the way the electric grid works in any way. In fact, electric grids have to be perfectly balanced in terms of electricity generation and electricity use at all times. It is always perfectly balanced. So I'm sitting in a room right now, and if I were to turn a light bulb on, instantaneously, the nearest power plant would generate a slightly larger amount of power to precisely balance that instantaneously. And it's not doing this with computers or artificial intelligence. It is due to the engineering of the grid. This goes back over 100 years, the way we've made this work. This is why when you go to most military bases, you might have these beautiful solar panel arrays set up. But if the grid goes down, the first thing they do is they shut off the solar panels because it's so difficult to manage intermittent power on small microgrids. Where intermittent power works beautifully is when you have a large, large grid covering, you know, say half the country. And then, it's sunny over here and it's cloudy over there and we could average everything out and then it works. It works beautifully. But in order to have resilient power 24/7 and clean power, and by clean, I mean steady current, typically in the DoD, that means diesel. Whether you care about climate change or not, just from a purely strategic perspective, that is a huge vulnerability to depend on large amounts of liquid logistics arriving on a daily basis.
You talked a little bit about the difference between paper reactors and prototypes. And it seems to me that what you trade in is prototypes. I like that better than something on paper because I see a lot of garbage on paper and I like to see things done myself. How is it possible in this regulatory environment where we hear often that, or at least I've heard, that bringing a reactor online can take 30 years? How are you doing this? How are you getting away with this?
Yeah, there's actually this fascinating tension going on right now because there is a ton of hype around new nuclear. And it's great that people are excited and it's great that people are investing. But the timelines are sometimes a little bit out of whack on what's realistic. And while 30 years is on the extreme end, what is very typical is 15 to 20 years for a regulating reactor. And part of this is due to stuff that should be reformed. There is definitely room in the regulatory space for reform. There are some regulations that don't make sense. We bang our head against a wall. But also, a lot of this is because you have to be safe. Nuclear power is the safest form of energy in the world, but it's that way because we have a zero tolerance. We accept that planes will occasionally crash and kill people. We do not accept that nuclear reactors can melt down and kill people. And so because of that, we have to be extraordinarily resilient in what we have to analyze. So for my reactor, you know, we have to think about, well, what happens if the whole system breaks and it's been hacked and everything's in the wrong position and everything's on fire and there's a flood and it's a hot day and no one gets there for 72 hours to do anything about it? And you go, well, that seems awfully unlikely that all those things are going to go wrong at the same time. But the standard is we can't have any radiation release. It's because of these standards that things have been so safe. So you bring up Three Mile Island, everybody knows Three Mile Island, but they don't realize that no radiation was released by Three Mile Island. There was no harm to the nearby population. And it's because the nuclear safety standards required the steel vessel that uranium was in to be so thick and so resilient that even when the entire core melted down and you had this gooey liquid uranium stuff, it couldn't break through the steel. The steel actually held it all inside and nothing was released. Now that adds cost and that adds regulatory time, but that's the standard that we've set. And I think we need to stick with that. Some people say, well, you know, why don't we let reactors blow up like, SpaceX blows up rockets? And I don't think that's acceptable. I don't think the American people would accept that. I think we need to have this standard of zero failures. But within that, there is room for having the regulatory process move faster. We have a really good partner on Project Pele with the Department of Energy, and in particular, the folks at Idaho National Laboratory, who have been really motivated to say, how can we regulate reactors better? How can we regulate them faster and have regulations that make more sense for these advanced non-light water designs? These designs are much safer than what came before, and so we can regulate them differently while maintaining that standard of zero failures. And so I think more than anything, what has allowed us to move fast has been the team at Idaho, and particularly DOE Idaho, the field office there, who have been really motivated to say, how can we modify the regulations that in a way that we can actually get this reactor built, you know, before the heat death of the universe?
Can we just not talk about the heat death of the universe at all? Let's just, we don't go all the way dark on this podcast, you know, Armageddon adjacent maybe, but let's not tip over. One of the things that you talk a little bit about in public is that there's like an immediate value to nuclear. And we just talked a little bit about what a grid is. But one of the things I find interesting is nuclear is actually contributing to the grid right now. But at what percentage level, how is that happening? And is there a way to optimize that? Can we make this better and still not be concentrating something so much in 1, 2, 3, 4, 8 locations to the extent that becomes a lovely target for an adversary?
Yeah. So on the U.S. electric grid as a whole, nuclear power is about 20% of our electric grid. And what's fascinating about it being that high is that we've effectively not built any of them since the 70s. We have built only 2 reactors from scratch to add to the grid since 1978. So those reactors that are providing all that power were primarily constructed in the 60s and the early to mid 70s. A lot of them are on 80-year licenses, and the NRC is already talking about extending some of them to 100-year licenses. Now, the real value that they provide on the grid is to provide that baseload power. I think there's a general agreement among experts on the grid that you have to have something dispatchable that you can guarantee will be able to provide power all the time and can be there when it's dark and when it's not windy. Right now, the existing technologies that we have to provide baseload power are fossil fuels and hydro, geothermal, and nuclear. We've pretty much dammed up all the rivers we're going to dam up in the United States, so that's topped out. And geothermal is great. There's progress being made there, but that's also very limited where you can do it. It's not going to work here in Virginia. And so if we'd like to start moving off fossil fuels, the way to replace that is with nuclear. And I think there's a lot of momentum there. You know, the Biden administration announced a goal to triple the amount of nuclear on the electric grid by 2050. And I'm expecting that the Trump administration is going to be a big supporter of nuclear as well. Nuclear has extraordinary bipartisan support on Capitol Hill in a way that nothing does because of this. I like to bring up the example that about 6 months ago, Congress passed a bill to try to reform the NRC. It was called the ADVANCE Act, and it passed the Senate 88-2. And I don't know if you've been following Congress lately, but when they try to name, you know, new post offices after war heroes, that doesn't pass 88-2. I mean, nothing gets that level of support. And it's because of the recognition that nuclear is unique in its ability to provide baseload power, to get us off fossil fuels, and also the geopolitical implications of leading the world in nuclear power. Our responsibility on Pele and other government nuclear programs is we have to actually deliver. There's been a lot of hype around nuclear, and we have to actually deliver actual hardware so that we can move forward and have this clean, reliable power going forward.
You know, they're very good at naming post offices. I mean, I'll be frank. I think they really get to business on that. I don't know if you ever look at congress.gov or GovTrack.
Oh, it's like half of what they do.
Oh, they are so good at that. You know, they're on it. So let's say that we lost 20% of the power on the grid. What would the consequences be? And then reversing that, what if we could increase it by 30%? What would that do? And where would nuclear sort of fit into that discussion?
Well, if we lost 20% of the electric grid tomorrow, we would be back in the Stone Ages, effectively, because the electric grid would collapse. And I try to remind people that we've actually never experienced a real blackout in the United States. We've had partial areas suffer blackouts. I remember back in, I think, 2003, when a bunch of the East Coast lost power. But the grid was still actually up and functional at that time. The closest we've ever come to a real blackout was the Texas snowstorm a few years ago, you may remember, where they were 3 minutes away from shutting off the grid. They were outside the safety bounds and they were 3 minutes away. There have been studies of what would happen if you actually had a blackout. And the estimate is that the whole grid would take about 2 months to get back online. We would be without power for 2 months as a country. So we definitely can't handle that. In terms of adding new power, a lot of this comes down to what we think is going to happen to the United States going forward. So if you look at the total energy demand of the United States, from the first half of the 20th century all the way up to the 70s, it grew rapidly. And we kind of stagnated. The amount of electricity that we generate has actually not increased that much over the last 50 years. We've been relatively flat. It's gone up a little bit, but not much. But now if you look at the predictions based on what people think is going to happen with AI and everything else, suddenly these predictions that the energy demand is going to grow rapidly, that we're going to see like a 30 or 40% increase in demand in the next few decades. And if that's true, something has to provide that. Solar and wind can be part of it, but they can't be the majority of it. The grid has to have something that is providing that reliable power. In the short term, what that's going to be is gas. The build out of gas is extraordinary. And if you look at worldwide, gas is still growing faster than solar and wind combined. And it's because that's what we've decided in Western world is we're going to do gas. That, you know, coal is the energy of the past, and now we're doing gas. Someone branded gas as natural gas, and we think it's kind of clean. I don't know how that happened, but it's a beautiful marketing effort. And so gas demand is growing rapidly. But even gas is limited. I've talked to some of the companies that are getting into data centers. And they'll tell you that if you want to build a new gas plant now, the long lead time for hardware is like 6-7 years out at this point. Everything is at the limits. So how we deal with the situation, how we bring electricity on the grid and balance that with what we think the demands are going to be for power is going to be maybe the most difficult policy challenge that the country has for the rest of this decade.
Let's talk about what nuclear can fill here. Is the grid at capacity, and do we need to get off our butts and do more of this? Like, how do we resolve this if we do? Yeah.
So if you look at the amount of excess margin we have in the U.S. electric grid, it has been on the decline the last couple of decades. It's why we've seen that brownouts and blackouts have been happening more commonly in the United States over the last 20 years.
And not when it's throttled by Enron execs, if you remember.
Right. Yeah. But if you look at the problems you have in the U.S., that pales in comparison with what's going on in Europe, where they're having serious, serious energy problems because they've rejected nuclear and now they've been cut off from Russian gas. And it's led to a significant decline in energy demand. The poster child of this is obviously Germany. The estimate in 2025 is that Germany will use less electricity this year than they have used in any year since the country was reformed in 1991. You look at a lot of their industry has been leaving the country because even with government subsidies, the price of electricity is just way too high to compete on industrial processes. It's basically a deindustrialization is what is happening. And so we can look at Europe and say that, well, this is where we might be in 15 or 20 years if we have bad energy policy. That's why I just think this is such a critical problem to deal with right now, to try to bring more energy online in time so that we don't have all the problems that we're seeing in places like Germany.
That's interesting because the policy in Germany, and correct me if I'm wrong, maybe you have a better recall of this, but Angela Merkel was seeking to have some sort of a detente, if you will, with Russia. And so they decommissioned their nuclear reactors, which in retrospect seems like, you know, idiot soup. Like, what in the heck were you thinking? Are you out of your mind? And then they ran in the Nord Stream or whatever it was, the pipeline from Russia for natural gas. And now Russia can be Enron, right? You can't turn your stove on in Bavaria if Russia decides they've had it with you. And they are losing industry, and they were masters of engineering, and I would say mechanical engineering, to be clear. And they're now in a position where they can't really do that. And then they have the demands of labor industry. And as a result of that, they're experiencing, from my observation, I guess, from my reading of international news, a massive deindustrialization that actually threatens their national security, in my view.
Yeah. So what you're describing, forgive my German accent, but it's Energiewende. Which was, the Angela Merkel policy. You know, I'm not an expert on German domestic policy, something about the coalition that the CDU formed, but the Greens and whatever. I'm not an expert on that. But yes, it has been a total disaster. And the amazing thing about it is that a lot of those nuclear reactors could actually be turned back on relatively easily. There are reactors in Germany that could be put back on the grid in a year if they put some money in. And so it's like you're staring at the abyss, guys, and you have options. Where, contrast that to the United States, where we don't have all these reactors that we just shut down. And if we want new nuclear to come online, that's going to require tens of billions of dollars and years and years and years to make happen. Germany actually has reactors ready to go right now. In fact, what's crazy about it is that they still have operators who show up every day. By German law, these reactors that have been shut down, because they're still there, the operators have to show up every day as if they're going to operate the reactor, and they just sit there staring at black screens, and they get paid a full salary, and then they go home.
Okay, that's a great movie right there. There's the premise. I mean, you've got to be kidding. You know, I spent some time in Germany. Oh my gosh.
So anyway, we could stare at this and go like, well, okay, this is what could happen if we have bad energy policy. We could be doing this in 20 years, staring at black screens while we desperately try to find backhanded ways to get Russian gas.
Let's not do that. Okay.
All the stuff that Europe's doing right now.
That's insane. That is just wild. Let's go back to a few thoughts. We're kind of drawing a circle right now. Let's go to Congress, regulations, appropriations, and going back to Pele. So how is it that you've been able to move with a Newt-like alacrity on Pele's development? Everything in Washington goes at a certain pace. There's a certain way that things unfold. I find that Washington moves way too slow. How on earth did you pull this off, and how were you able to get it done?
Well, we're not done yet, to be clear. I mean, we are building Pele, but it's not turned on yet. So there's still a couple of years of really hard work to go. There's kind of a general theory of government which says that it's really hard to fix government. And what you do is you form new organizations. And so that's what we do in the Department of Defense, is like every 10 years we go, hey, we're really bad at developing new hardware, so let's create a new rapid prototyping office. And so that's what my office is. We were founded in 2012 by Ash Carter at that time in the Obama administration. I wasn't there at the time, but that's what happened. And the idea was, okay, let's create an office that can be outside the JSIDS process, if you know the terminology, kind of the normal acquisition process that they do in the DoD. And we do everything through OTAs, other transactional authority. And the catch is you have to really trust your personnel, because you're now operating with the freedom that allows you to really screw up, right? You could waste tens of millions of dollars if you don't know what you're doing. And so they just have to have that trust that we can execute. But because you move fast, it attracts talented people. So when we go to the national labs and say, hey, who wants to help us on Pele? Everyone wants to help. And so we've been able to kind of pick and choose the best experts that we can find. We say, hey, we need this particular steel alloy and we're struggling with it. Well, let's find the guy at Argonne who literally wrote the standard for that material, and let's bring him in. And that is what has allowed us to move as fast as we have, just the incredible talent that we have supporting the program.
Well, that's pretty awesome, because things don't go fast, and it sounds like it actually is. But you had mentioned previously that there is no partisan divide over nuclear. You know, 88-2 is really pretty incredible. Why do you think that's the case? And is there a moment here that can be leveraged to maybe see that more of this kind of thing with respect to nuclear happens in the long-term interests of the United States defense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll always be this way. I mean, I do think this is a moment, and we have to hit while the iron's hot, because politics can shift. And I think politics has shifted in the United States. I don't think it was this bipartisan 10, 15 years ago. Traditionally, nuclear fission is seen as something that is more of a Republican thing than a Democrat thing. And I think what has changed that, and what led really all the leadership of the Biden administration to support nuclear, was recognizing the need to have baseload power, basically recognizing that you can't run a grid entirely on solar and wind. It's just not going to happen. Because I think for a while, people were living in this fiction. The example I love to give is that there are towns and areas that have claimed to be zero carbon for a long time. And one of my favorite examples is Burlington, Vermont. It claimed to be the first city in the United States to be fully 100% renewable. They've been that way for over a decade now. They announced it, I think, in 2014. And then when Russia invaded Ukraine, the electricity prices jumped way up in Burlington. And there's a fantastic interview on Vermont Public Radio I've listened to, where some experts on there trying to explain to the people why they allegedly get all their power from renewables, yet their electricity prices jumped when Russia invaded Ukraine. And the answer is because, like all grids, most of the power is coming from baseload. And so in Burlington, it's gas. But they buy carbon credits and they get to pretend that all their power is coming from solar and wind. Well, the country as a whole can't pretend in that way. You have to have an actual baseload to make your grid work. And Democrats recognize that, well, it could be fossil fuels, or it could be this thing that doesn't emit carbon. And so I think that has brought a lot of the people over to say, hey, this is the path to actually getting a full 100% carbon-free grid requires nuclear power. There's just no other way to do it until someone invents fusion or some, you know, antimatter device that doesn't exist yet that can provide power.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.